Elected officials is that his clients, 10 of the 65 firearm manufacturers in Illinois, provide good jobs. And he says bans and regulations distract from other issues, like funding mental health programs. But that hasn't stopped people like Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who's called on the city to divest pension funds from any account that involves gun makers. Emanuel's plan was heard in Springfield, and now Democratic State Representative Christian Mitchell is calling for similar measures.
When large majorities say they want an assault weapons ban, when people say it doesn't make sense to have, you know, guns in schools and parks and on public transportation, for God's sake, and you are lobbying against those efforts for purely financial gain, you've crossed the line.
Mitchell says gun violence is the single largest domestic issue facing the country right now, and he says divestment isn't a new concept. The state took similar actions against companies that do business with Iran and Sudan.
You know, I don't want to make a direct comparison, but I do want to say that I think the principle of what we want to be invested in and what we believe is doing damage to our communities and to our state and our country is the same in that way.
Except there are a few hitches in this plan. One is actual impact. For example, university employees sent out a memo saying it's $113,000 of shares in gun manufacturers make up 0.00% of the total fund's investments. Another issue is the gun industry is making bank. If you go to manufacturers' websites right now, most say they have a backlog of orders.
It's hard to see what positive outcome might come from divesting other than it just protects the credibility of the city itself.
Braden King teaches at Northwestern University. He says divesting hasn't gotten companies to change the way they do business, partly because someone else usually picks up the stock that's dropped. Also, he says it's not like gun makers do well on the stock market after mass shootings.
Investors have already taken into account a lot of this risk. But if a lot of activists of a lot of cities are willing to divest, it may send additional signals, which may increase the perceptions that this asset is actually quite risky.
King says the way to make a difference can come through stockholder activism, when someone buys stock to address issues from the inside or at stockholder meetings. But Jay Keller, the gun manufacturer's lobbyist, says there's a danger if state government approves regulations against gun makers. They'd be running providers to local police departments out of Illinois. Keller wonders then, where would they go for their guns? I'm Tony Arnold.
You're listening to WYLL. I'm Chris Berube. Every month, we do a community cinema event that's organized by WILL, and tonight, we're going to be showing the documentary The Island President about Mohamed Nasheed, the former president of the Maldives. Here's a clip from the trailer.
If we can't stop the seas rising, if you allow for a 2-degree rise in temperature, you are actually agreeing to kill us. I have an objective, which is to save a nation. I know it's a huge task.
Joining me now is Henry Radcliffe. He organizes the monthly community cinema events. So, Henry, what's The Island President about exactly?
Hello, Chris. The Island President is, like you said, about a former president, Mohamed Nasheed of the Maldives. His country sits about 8 feet above sea level. And as ice is melting up on the different poles and the water levels are rising around the planet, his country is going to be underwater if things don't change. And that was a big mission for him back in 2009. He took that thought to a global summit in Copenhagen and pled his case on the world stage.
So the Maldives, it's a country that I don't think about ever, to be honest. I mean, where is it in the world and what is it like?
Well, the Maldives are 1,200 coral islands southeast of India in the Indian Ocean.
1,200, really?
Yes. And of the 1,200, 200 are inhabited and 80 of them have tourist resorts. It's considered the lowest-lying country on the planet. It's a very beautiful place, which the documentary shows over and over. At one point, the president makes a comment about it's like paradise in paradise, and it is. It's such a beautiful place, but it's also an extremely vulnerable place because of its location.
So essentially, it's so low-lying that the thought is that if climate change continues at the pace that some scientists are saying, that it'll be underwater within a number of years. Is that right?
That's correct. And the number of years is not a large number. As we're watching the film, which was done about 4 years ago, we can see some of the damage that was done by the tsunami that came through a little bit earlier. And some of the islands are no longer inhabitable just because of climate rising and the conditions that are there now.
So let's talk a bit about Mohammed Nasheed. He seems like this guy who he was educated in the West. I saw that he was educated in England. He's somebody who came back to the Maldives. It really seems like he came back with a sense of mission. Specifically, it seems like he came back, as he says in the film, because he wants to save his country.
Yes, he wanted to save his country from a couple of things. The former leader, Mamoun Gayoom, was somewhat of a dictator. Mohammed Nasheed was one of the leaders of the pro-democracy movement that was trying to unseat Mr. Gayoom, and he was successful. Nasheed was the first democratically elected president in the country. Nasheed came into the country. He was a very shrewd president, and he knew what he needed to do to bring the plight of his country on the world stage. He didn't think that from the Maldives he would be able to plead their case, and he knew that he had to have everyone's attention, so he made it his mission to get to Copenhagen so that he could talk on the world stage about the climate change that was affecting his country.
It's so interesting because the Copenhagen summit was about these giant global problems. It was about trying to solve climate change, this thing that really threatens everybody. And yet he was coming to make this very specific, very personal case saying, look, this is, I know we're worried about these giant problems that threaten all of the world, but this will kill my people, essentially. This will kill a very small number of people, but it will, you know, make a big difference for us.
Yes, that was his main argument. But it's not necessarily a small number of people. There are about 395,000 people living in the Maldives. So it's not necessarily a small number, but definitely their plight is an immediate plight. It's not like in 15 or 20 years, they are losing ground on their country now as we're speaking.
So coming into the film, I mean, it's kind of an inspirational story about this person trying to be heard. What else did you take away from it? What were kind of the big things that you learned watching this movie?
One thing that I took from it is because of where we live and some of the things that we're used to, we don't have an appreciation for how fragile situations are in other parts of our planet. As we look at the Maldives, some of us might have an impression of it as a tourist resort or this really idyllic place to kind of, you know, it's an island, it's out there, and we have an idea of what island life is like. But it's a really dramatic situation in that they don't really have control over how the climate change is affecting them, but it is definitely affecting them, and they're going to have to react to it. And if they can't have any input from the people that are causing some of the changes, then, as he said, at one point they asked, well, what happens if we don't reach any kind of conclusions? And he just says, we'll die. Their nation will be underwater.
So tell me a bit about the movie. It's playing tonight at the Champaign Public Library. And do you guys have a panel organized for this?
Right. I have a panel. Mike Timlin of the Illinois Water Survey will be there, and Mara Eisenstein. She's the director of marketing and special projects at Illinois Green Business Associates.
Well, it's bound to be a really interesting event. Henry, it's always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me here.
Support comes from the Illinois Symphony Orchestra with violinist Nicholas Kendall in Virtuosic Vibe with Sibelius Violin Concerto, Strauss Death and Transfiguration, and a world premiere by Steve Hackman. 8 p.m. Friday, April 12th at Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts and Saturday, April 13th at Sangamon Auditorium. Details at ilsymphony.org.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 9th of April, 2013. It was on this day, 1833, the first tax-supported public library in America opened in Peterborough, New Hampshire. Today there are more than 9,000 public libraries in this country, including the one in Peterborough, which is still going strong. It was Jorge Luis Borges who said, "I have always imagined that paradise will be a kind of library." And it was Dr. Johnson, Samuel Johnson, who said, "No place affords a more striking conviction of the vanity of human hopes than a public library." It's the birthday of the scientist who, along with his co-worker, Minxu Chang, discovered that the hormone progesterone would work to stop ovulation. And so they created the first birth control pills, which were approved by the federal government in 1960. Gregory Pincus, born in Woodbine, New Jersey, 1903. It was on this day, 1865, General Robert E. Lee surrendered to General Ulysses S. Grant, effectively ending the Civil War. Lee's and Grant's armies had converged in Appomattox, Virginia. Fighting began at dawn. Within a few hours, Lee realized that his troops were outnumbered and surrounded, and his choice was to carry on a guerrilla war or surrender with dignity. He said to his staff, "There is nothing left for me to do but to go and see General Grant, and I would rather die 1,000 deaths." But he dressed up in a crisp new uniform, his red silk sash, gloves, a ceremonial sword. He thought he might be taken as a prisoner of war as he rode his horse, traveler, to the front lines under a flag of truce in full view of the Union Army. Asked for a meeting with Grant, that he wanted to discuss the question of surrender. So there was a ceasefire, and when Grant got the news, he sent word to Lee that he, Lee, should choose the time and place for a meeting. They found an abandoned brick house in town. Lee came in alone. General Grant came with a dozen of his generals and officers. They reminisced about the Mexican-American War, and then Grant brought up the subject of surrender. After the terms had been written and signed, Robert E. Lee rode back to his camp, and his soldiers were lined up alongside the road. They were cheering for him. He began to cry, and men reached out and patted his horse as he rode past. And it's the birthday of Hugh Hefner, Chicago, 1926, who put together the first issue of Playboy in his kitchen on $8,000, most of which he'd borrowed. That was in 1953. He had Marilyn Monroe on the cover and sold more than 50,000 copies. Here's a poem for today by William Carlos Williams, "The Widow's Lament in Springtime." Sorrow is my own yard,